May it please the court, Tim Hyland and Elizabeth Dwyer for Michael Hotung. I'd reserve, if I may, 2 minutes for rebuttal, the court will allow. We're here because the trial court erred in sustaining Eric Hotung's murder and his detrimental reliance claim under Virginia law. And that's because that claim was governed by District of Columbia law. Now, just by way of a little bit of background, because it colors how this all comes before the court, is that the Hotung name is a fairly well-known one. They're akin to the Rockefellers in some circles. It's an entree for people, power, prestige, opportunity, whatever it might be, in both business, social, whatever, diplomatic for that matter. And with that, within the context of their world, comes responsibility. And so in 2007, Eric, and I'll refer to them by their first names if I might, so you can quite understand this. Eric was having a building, or donated a large sum of money to Georgetown University, $5 million, which is in the District of Columbia, as you know, to erect a building on their law school campus on Capitol Hill. And it's there today. It's called the Eric Hotung International Law Building. And Eric, at the time, also resided across the river in McLean, Virginia. He wanted a D.C. office in this building, and for various reasons, he and Georgetown got into a dispute over how that office was to be fit up, what the office was to look like. Would it have marble or would it have drywall? That's it. And they got into a dispute, and Eric took the prince of his empire, the person who 6 years before he had said, "You're my son, I'm going to treat you as a family member," and said, "You need to pony up here." And Michael, the appellant here, came in and paid $250,000 for that fit-up work to resolve that dispute with Georgetown University. Now, and in exchange, they put a plaque up that said it was given in honor of Eric by his loving son. Now, that's you have to now step back 6 years, in fact, step back 48 years, because for 42 years of his life, Michael was sort of a guy without an identity. And in 2001, Eric proclaimed in the press, and again, because these folks are very well known, this was a big deal, that, hey, by the way, this is my son. This is what Michael Mack is his name. Is my son. And thereafter, he promised that and acknowledged that Michael would be treated and recognized and confirmed as his son and would be treated as such for purposes of business, financial, what have you. And Michael acted in accordance with that and again, went out and helped build the brand, this Hotung name. And part of that was this $250,000. And when Eric in 2009 then pulled the rug out, and that's the subject of sort of both of these appeals, so we'll go into a lot of it, but Eric goes out to the press and says, you know what, he's an imposter, this guy's a fraud, he's not really this, which was false, and even Eric admits that. He broke the promise. And that's what promissory estoppel is all about. And I'll just concede right up front, Virginia, this court has rejected promissory estoppel as a cause of action. No question about it. But what this court hasn't done is disregarded the conflicts of law rules that the courts are to abide by, and that's why we're here, because this claim is governed by District of Columbia law, which indeed does recognize promissory estoppel. And that is the crux of the trial court's error. Now, on brief, there's some scuffling as to whether everyone agrees, I think, and I think the law is pretty clear, that promissory estoppel from a choice of law perspective is treated like a contract would be as opposed to a tort type analysis. It sounds in contract for purposes of the choice of law. And it doesn't really much matter whether you apply, as the appellee would, the place of formation here test, or whether you apply, as we would suggest, the place of performance test. It doesn't matter, because in either event, the answer is the District of Columbia. The only way we get off track here and start talking about Hong Kong law and Virginia law or in law of wherever it might be is to digress entirely from where the complaint, from what the complaint says. And this is on demur. So we're limited to the complaint and reasonable inferences therefrom. And what that says is that this all went down, every bit of it went down, with respect to the Georgetown University matter, which is all that's before the court, in the District of Columbia. That's it. And there's nothing in the complaint about anybody promising anything to anyone in Hong Kong. There's nothing about anyone performing anywhere other than the District of Columbia. And indeed, all of the talk about, well, Eric did all of this in Hong Kong and everything like that is belied by the fact that, in fact, what the record shows is that Eric pretty much, I mean, he's not like you and me. Eric isn't a guy that just lives in one place and sits there. He has apartments all over the world and what have you. But Eric's residence, for the most part, where his family lived, where he had full-time staff, all of that, was in McLean, Virginia, all the time, just 5 miles, I dare say, from Georgetown's campus. This is not a matter of just some guy who's sitting in Hong Kong the whole time. And they want to just blithely say, well, this all happened in Hong Kong. That's not supported by the complaint. And what we have to look here is at the allegations. So that until 2002, and again, that was when this case was well underway, Eric was right here. So bottom line is the trial court erred in the first instance by saying, okay, we're going to govern this claim by Virginia law, and I'm just going to discard it right off the top. Not considered by the court then were the elements, and we've outlined that in the on brief, and I won't belabor it here unless the court wishes, but I would just point out that there has to be a promise. The promise must reasonably induce reliance, and the promise must be relied upon to a detriment. Working backwards, the detriment obviously is this payment of $250,000 to Georgetown. Did he reasonably rely? Well, we did allege that specifically. I can give paragraph numbers if you wish. And then there's the promise. And if we go to, we discussed the promise in multiple paragraphs of the complaint. But the bottom line is when you crunch them all together, is that Michael would be acknowledged, treated, recognized, and confirmed going forward as Eric's son and would be treated as such for purposes of business and financial endeavors. And Eric broke the promise, and that promise was relied upon by Michael. And again, and that cost him, within the limited scope of what this appeal is, $250,000. So for that reason, we would suggest that sustaining that demur was an error, and the court should remand it to allow for a trial on the merits as to count two of the complaint.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lee Berlick and I represent Eric Hotan. Trial court's decision to sustain the demur, the detrimental reliance claim, should be affirmed for two key reasons. First, Commonwealth of Virginia does not recognize a cause of action for detrimental reliance or promissory estoppel. There's no dispute about that. Secondly, while the District of Columbia does recognize a cause of action for promissory estoppel, the allegations of the complaint do not even come close to setting forth the minimum elements of the claim under District of Columbia law.
Did you argue that to the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where did you argue that to the trial court?
We should have a transcript of the hearing.
Well, we may not have the transcript of the hearing in the...
Did you state that in your demur?
In the appendix. Well, there was a 5-page limit. I remember there was a paragraph. I think we do have that in here.
I have, I have your memorandum.
293.
Failed to state a claim that this detrimental health and alliance is not a recognized cause of action in Virginia. And here's everything you say about count two. Detrimental reliance, also known as promissory estoppel, is not an independent cause of action in Virginia. Promissory estoppel is not a cognizable cause of action in Virginia. Count two fails to state a claim under Virginia law.
Okay. Well, okay, that sounds right. We had oral arguments, and at oral argument is when they raised and argued that District of Columbia law would apply.
Mm-hmm. And you said it wouldn't because Virginia doesn't apply D.C. law.
Well,
that appears to be the only question in front of us right now to that particular count.
The only question is
whether or not that count should have been dismissed because Virginia is not capable of applying D.C. law under our conflict of law principles.
I think there's two aspects to it. First is whether or not Virginia recognizes the claim. The issue is whether or not the
Virginia doesn't recognize promissory estoppel.
So the issue is whether the court was correct in sustaining the demur.
Yeah, that's the assignment of error.
Right.
The only thing in front of us.
Right.
We are not called upon to decide, based upon how this was set up at the trial level, we are incapable of deciding whether from a D.C. perspective, it was a good pleading or a bad pleading.
Well,
the only thing we're capable of deciding is, could Virginia apply D.C. law with regard to promissory estoppel or detrimental reliance or whatever?
I don't think that's the only issue, Your Honor. Because first
then
the question
tell
is...
Me, then show me where it is in your demur, where it is in the brief to the trial court, or where it is in the transcript.
Well, are we talking about preservation of error, or are we talking about what the
counsel,
issue...
Counsel, on a demur, we can only rule upon the grounds that you stated for your demur at the trial level. I have found one, and that is Virginia doesn't recognize a cause of action for promissory estoppel. His response is, there is no Virginia law of promissory estoppel, but conflict of laws principles require us, under comity, to look to D.C. law. You are now making a second argument. You're saying, even if you look to D.C. law, this doesn't get over the hurdle. That is not a question that is before us today.
Okay, well, if that's the case, the court is still correct to sustain the demur, because you don't look... You don't apply ordinary choice of law principles when you have a situation like this. We're not just talking about differences in how District of Columbia may define, you know, consideration from Virginia. We're talking about a cause of action that, under Virginia public policy, Commonwealth of Virginia does not recognize.
You, counsel, you did not argue public policy to the circuit court, did you?
I didn't say public policy. I said that Commonwealth of Virginia does not recognize that as a cause of action.
That's not a public policy argument. That argument leads to a response. Well, yes, it does, because conflict of laws principles require us to apply the law of the other jurisdiction.
Well, at oral argument, though, there was argument, and I don't think it's in the appendix, but it's in the record, there was argument as to which state's law does apply, and they continue to argue that it's D.C., but it's clearly not District of Columbia law, and that was argued to the trial court, because there are no allegations of a promise anywhere in the complaint. I mean, they talk about...
Counsel, that's not part of your demur. Your demur is simply Virginia doesn't recognize this cause of action, period. And if we find that under conflict of laws principles, we are required to give full faith and credit to the D.C. cause of action in Virginia, then the demur should have been overruled.
Well, I mean, but it's a de novo standard of review, and it's a question of law. So even if that's the case, wouldn't this court
Counsel,
say...
You do not get the opportunity to argue here a demur that you did not argue at the trial court.
Well, all I'm trying to argue here is that the court was correct to sustain the demur. And it's a de novo standard, so...
Then argue why it was correct to reach the conclusion that conflict of laws principles do not govern this case.
Well, they don't because of public policy. It's the Willard case and under Ward's equipment. They held that it's a public... The fact that the state doesn't recognize promissory estoppel or detrimental reliance is a public policy issue. And there's the circuit court case discussed in the brief where the parties had actually agreed with a consent to jurisdiction clause and a choice of law clause that California law would apply. And the court said, well, even if the parties agree that we're going to have promissory estoppel and agree to apply California law, the public policy in Virginia is not to allow it. And so we're not going to enforce the parties' agreement, and we're not going to allow claim for detrimental reliance of promissory estoppel to be adjudicated in this.
Let me try approaching this from a slightly different direction. Let me make a statement of law, and that is that all personal actions are transitory and may be brought anywhere that the defendant may be found. As a general principle of law, would you agree with that? Personal actions are transitory at common law.
I don't know if that's true or not. But
I'll tell you it's true.
Okay.
Okay. Now, is promissory estoppel common law?
Well, as far as I know, it is.
Okay.
So we don't have it here in Virginia.
Now, but if, in fact, common law causes of action are transitory and the law can be applied wherever the defendant can be found under conflict of laws principles, then it would not even matter whether we have promissory law in Virginia, unless it violates the clear public policy of the Commonwealth, which is your argument at this moment.
Okay.
This is the first time you have made that argument. You did not make it to the trial court. We cannot hear it.
Well, then let me say that it's harmless error. Then, if it was an error, right? So it seems to me the issue is simply whether the court should or should not have sustained the demur.
You're saying you had no other grounds for your demur. We cannot apply harmless error to a demur where you only had one ground.
Well, I wouldn't have argued harmless error to the trial court. I'm saying if
counsel, you had one argument. A very simple one to the trial court. And that was, Virginia doesn't recognize this cause of action. If indeed you were capable of making another argument, we cannot hear it and say, that one was a good one. So even though you would have lost on this one, we're going to let you win on that one.
Well, I understand. My point is that if you were to send this back to Fairfax, we just go back in on a demur. I point out that this complaint doesn't come close to setting forth a cause of action for relief. It doesn't even allege a promise, the sine qua non of a promissory estoppel claim. And it's time barred. It's based on an admission made in 2007.
You would have the
it's
opportunity
going to be dismissed.
To make all of those arguments to the circuit court at the appropriate time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I
have nothing further unless the court has questions.
I don't see any. Thank you. Call the next case, please.